Today's episode of the Ryan Russillo Podcast on the Ringer Podcast Network is brought to you by State Farm. Just like sports, the game of life is unpredictable. Talk to a State Farm agent and get a teammate who can help you navigate the unexpected. And unpredictable. What would be unpredictable this week? Any ideas, Kyle?
Andy Dalton is off the banks.
How excited are you going to be? Will you buy an Andy Dalton jersey if he goes to the Pats?
No. So Bill's already got me out on. No, but at least there's some excitement with Stidham, I think. Bill already got me all riled up for don't get mediocre Andy Dalton. So I really that would be unexpected to me because I've already decided that the Patriots decided not to have Andy Dalton.
You know what would actually be predictable would be if Dalton ends up on the Pats and Bill in a couple weeks going, you know, I like it. Like, the more I've thought about it, the more I like it. Get a teammate who can help you navigate the unexpected. Talk to a State Farm agent today. The plan for a Thursday. Brian Curtis, long discussion. Just media, a bunch of different stuff. I hope you like it. We get into kind of the industry and our own paths a little there. I know I probably talk about it, but it's just kind of to be outside of the ESPN stuff and talk with somebody that covers ESPN. So there you go. We're going to do that with Brian Curtis. And I really do like his podcast, the Press Box podcast that he does here for Spotify and The Ringer. But we're going to start you off on kind of a getting into the weekend. Remember, this is the weekend coming up. For some of you, the weekend's already started, but you know, what are you going to do? We're going to do a little live mailbag for you. I don't know that it's really live because it is a podcast, but Kyle sent over a ton of emails. So I appreciate that. Again, if you want to email us for this segment, it is lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. And I'm ready to roll, Kyle, if you are ready. So we'll do that first. How's that sound?
Yeah, I can't wait.
Okay. All right. I like that you get the microphone there because people were worried about you there for a little while. Okay. I did flag the right ones here, I hope. I did. Okay. Let's start with everybody wants to be anonymous here.
Can you blame him?
No, but I don't. I think he's giving me a fake name here. Okay. I got to come up with, let's call this guy Frank. All right, Frank. First, I want to say I'm a huge fan. Can't tell you how much I appreciate the content. Okay. All right. Laying out some quick facts here. Here's my situation. 28, married a year and a half, been together 9 years total. Man, shout out for commitment. That's early, 19. What are you, from Canada? We'll find out. First kid on the way, due in July. Oh, both of us have lived in Michigan our whole lives. So there you go. Close to Canada. It was close. Currently live about 4 hours from both my parents and my wife's mom. Her dad passed away a few years ago. Sorry to hear about that. So he says, look, I'm at a job now. It's fine. A lot of you guys start these emails this way. So let's see what this one has. I don't love it, but I'm making decent money and it's stable. For example, I'm usually in an office setting every day, but I'm able to work from home since the start of the stay-at-home order. Shocker. A lot of us have, man. Which I'm super grateful for considering the millions who've lost their jobs. Well said. I was lucky enough to get hired straight out of college after getting to know a few of my professors who were well-connected in the industry that my degree is in. I've been at this place 5 years, climbed the ladder pretty quickly due to some fortunate circumstances from an entry-level position to director of ops. Now to the advice part. I have a potential job lined up in Colorado. My old boss took a job out there a year ago, has been adamant about creating a position for me to become his number two. You know what you need in any office is a strong number two. I've been considering this for months, slightly before we found out my wife was pregnant. So, okay. So he's considering this the whole time. And then that happened. He just found out the wife's pregnant. He's like, moving out west is the dream that both. Oh, he says his wife also has this dream because it sucks having solo dreams when you're married. Right, man. Since I can remember, we love the outdoors, having grown up in Michigan and living in a place like Glenwood Springs or, you know, Colorado. I'm trying to keep him anonymous here. Be right up our alley. Okay. It also includes a significant pay increase, which it should because of the difference in cost of living. Okay, so now here's the point. With our firstborn on the way, dynamics change a little. It's tough because I know we're going to want to be around family, but it's not like we live 20 minutes from them. It's now a 4-hour drive, one way to see them. 4 hours, one way to see parents. Is it still okay to pursue our dream of living out west if it means sacrificing distance between ourselves and our kid with families, especially considering everything going on with the coronavirus? Okay, He also says there's great relationships with the parents, by the way. I can tell you this. It's something I never thought about until I got older and then your friends start having families, is that the proximity to parents, parents that you get along with, is one of the greatest things ever when you're going to start a family, because you can, you have this freedom that a lot of other people aren't going to have. Like, having family around is one of the greatest things, because there's just an intimate trust there of these people watching over your kids. And it allows you that break that I think parents, you know, a lot of divorces, I always feel like, you know, you don't want to say it's the kid's fault, but the kid dynamic can change so much. And if you don't have the means, or you don't have the proximity, or somebody's really, really busy, the fairness and sharing of the kid can get totally screwed up. And, you know, somebody resents the other person, and all of a sudden it's like, I liked you, I just don't like this situation. So having said all those things, if they're 4 hours away, they might as well be 40 hours away. Because 4 hours, let's put it this way, anything over like a 2.5 hour drive is just far enough that it's not going to be like the pop-in, right? Like, my brother lives in Thousand Oaks, and I don't go see them all the time. And I just went to visit because they have a niece, or it's my niece, is technically the term. She's 1.5. And I spent the night up there and loved it, and was like, I love hanging out with my little niece here. But usually that's a 2 hour drive, depending on the day, you know. And this time it was an hour, and we're both like, yeah, it's not super convenient. So the point is I would say this. I always think everybody should move, even if you like where you're from. When people are in small, I think in small towns, it happens a little bit more. I know Martha's Vineyard, where I'm from, has it a lot, where it's this kind of thing where you just always want to be there. You like your little bubble. You feel safer. You're more protected. But if you don't have family like down the street and you want to live in Colorado, I'm a huge Colorado fan, I think everybody should always make the move once. And at this point, too, you can do it because your kid's not even going to be in school. So I would say absolutely make the move and worry about the other stuff later. I would not be making, I wouldn't decide to not move because of the coronavirus. That's not the way I would plan out anything. So I would say go ahead and move. I mean, it's great that you have a great relationship with your parents. I would love to have the kind of relationship where if I were starting a family and I knew like my mom and dad were coming over and the grandparents were going to be hanging out. Well, that's never going to happen for me. So I don't even think about it. Like, I don't even think about it, even though I could appreciate how much it would be great to have that as an option. But it sounds like you don't even have that as an option. So I would say, go ahead, pack up the bags, move to Colorado. You can always move home, because when you do move and you kind of regret the move, it makes you appreciate going home that much more. Boom. Problem solved. Next one. Oh, here's one. This guy wants to be called RD. His nickname is Research and Development. Oh, a script. I do get thrown a lot of these my way. Let's just put it this way. I need to be a tad more established before I can green light your idea. Okay. That's just something to think about before maybe you send me a proposal. But RD just chimes in. He didn't get the warning ahead of time. I've got a pilot done for the script I wrote and was wondering if I should pursue it. It's about a dynamic dude that gets into partying and it changes his life for better and for worse. Ooh. I want to show the good times, but also how this person evolved and devolved as a human being along the way. Think of a more fun, relatable version of Euphoria if you've seen it. Story takes place in Westchester, New York. Do you think this would work/be unique? I got to tell you, blink reaction, it feels a tad thin. It feels a little thin. When Bill Lawrence was on with us, creator of Scrubs, Spin City, Cougar Town, Whiskey Cavalier, he said that everybody he's ever met was always like, oh, I have this story and it's never been done before. And he's like, yeah, it has. It just didn't get made. This, I just think you needed a couple more characters here before it's just a guy who parties a lot and then we see the good side and bad side. I'm not saying it's a terrible idea. Write what you know, right, RD? But it's going to need a little bit more depth. That's my first guess. Let's do a quick read. Speaking of partying, during this time of social distancing, connecting with friends over beer today looks pretty different. As the original light beer, Miller Lite has always been there to bring people together in real life through Miller Time. Miller Time is a moment for people to come together in real life to connect over a few beers, but having Miller Time is tough when you can't be with your people. I'm most excited to see anyone, honestly. The script says, who do I most want to see? I don't really even care at this point. This has been a pretty intense isolation for your boy over here. So I'd be excited to get into an argument with a stranger at this point. Miller Lite is the beer that makes Miller Time possible. Miller Lite is the only original light beer that tastes great and is less filling, which means it won't get in the way of enjoying time with your people. You know what I've said about Miller Lite, right? That little can, that little white can of goodness. Just go. This feels like home. It feels like the end of the quarantine. I'm not guaranteeing it, but I just, you know. Miller Lite, the original light beer. While you're home, enjoy a classic available for delivery today. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories and 3.2 carbs per 12 ounces. Okay, another one. This guy just turned 27, and his question is, should I buy a house or a condo? Kyle, are you a homeowner, Greg?
Shocker, I'm not.
Not a huge... Any plans?
Still boosting the credit. It does kill me to pay rent. It really does.
Where's the credit score right now?
It's like sevens. It's fluctuating. You know, the thing is there's, did you know there's two credit scores?
Well, what do you mean?
Well, it depends. Well, it depends on, so I went to get a loan for something and, you know, I got my stuff through the Chase app and I could see my credit score thing, or no, it's through Capital One, credit wise or something. And I thought my shit was like through the roof. And then I went to go, you know, down to put the pen to paper and they're like, hey, so we have to use the lowest one that we could find. And Experian, which is, I think, the standard, is a little bit different than what mine says. So I'm still trying to work through that.
And when you get older, you're going to learn there's a third credit score. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
So you know there's three different companies that do your credit score.
So it's Experian. It's, is it like Western Connection or something? What's it called?
That sounds like a dating website. No, it's TransUnion and Equifax.
TransUnion, that's what it is.
Right. So you're going to do, like, there's all those credit repair things. You know what? You know what fixes your credit score? Paying your fucking bills, okay? I signed up for that stuff. Look, I screwed it up in my 20s, like a lot of people do. You don't understand. I also think credit scores can be a bit like being a social outcast, where if you know everybody in your town already thinks you're a weirdo, it's the same thing with your credit score. Like when it's low, then you keep making decisions that aren't ever going to help.
On par, you're like, whatever. On par with your score.
Yeah, you're just like, whatever. My credit sucks anyway, so now I don't care. And it wasn't like I was charging stuff on a credit card and not paying it. It was just, you know, I got behind on my student loans because of an arrangement that didn't get fulfilled, and I was screwed. So I took a job for no money thinking the student loan thing, I was going to be fine. And then I wasn't. And then I was like, all right, well, this is shattering all of it. But yes, there's three scores. The whole credit score thing's stupid. Like the fact that mine will go down as I'm trying to refi something, because then they farm it out to a bunch of different people to run your number and then it goes down. Or when I bought the last house I bought, the guy tried to come back at me and say, oh, the credit score got dinged a little bit. I was like, well, that's because I have a ton of credit card like balance, but it's not over 30 days. He's like, yeah, the credit card balance is a little high. And, you know, we might have to tweak the number a little bit, which I think is total bullshit anyway, that they were just trying to do this to mess with the score a little. And I go, the only reason the credit card balance is high right now is because I actually am moving across the country and I've had a lot of expenses in these last 30 days. Like, you get that, right? Like that I would be spending more normally than, you know, usual on a credit card because I can't tell if today's podcast sucks or is, I don't know. Like, hey, yeah, Rosillo went for 12 minutes on the flaws of credit. Credit scores are...
It's tricky, man.
Yeah, part of it I get, but there's another part of it that's really nasty. Like, if you close out a credit card you don't want anymore, then your credit score goes down. Like, what is that? Like, if anything, it should be like, hey, look how stable this guy is. He's getting back to paper bills. Scores through the roof. Okay, so let's call our guy AJ. Because I just turned 27, doing the whole corporate accounting thing in Columbus. Sneaky nice Columbus City, he says. Right. I would agree. 10 years ago, not the case. He's been living with roommates the past few years, which is awesome. More fun, keeps the rent cheap. My roommate is moving in with his girlfriend at the end of the summer. I will most likely be living by myself and thinking about buying a small place condo, but I don't know if that's just me forcing it because that's what everyone is doing around me. Life advice for buying your first place. Any regrets from your first home purchase? Should I keep renting? Okay. So we talked with you, Kyle, about that. How old are you?
26.
Yeah, 26, LA property. It's probably not coming around the corner. Let's get that credit back around. Let's start putting a certain number that you have to make yourself save before you buy yourself vapes or anything like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the only way you can do it.
I got the automatic savings out happening right now.
Yeah, you got to take it out. It doesn't even exist. And then it just grows on its own like weeds in the back.
Kind of crazy.
Yeah, isn't it?
First time.
My first time home purchase was weird because I thought I was getting married and I was buying a place with somebody else. And then that, like, while we were looking for the place, we broke up. So I was like, all right. So then I kept looking at like mini Connecticut mansions because I just thought that that's what I was supposed to do. And the realtor's like, you realize you get, like, you're probably not starting a family now. So I was like, yeah, that's fair. So I went condo townhouse because I was also doing college football a lot. And I didn't realize, like, I never wanted to be a condo guy. But what I didn't realize is that when you're gone all the time and that stuff gets taken care of and people mow your lawn and all that kind of stuff. And I wouldn't even say they did a great job with it. It is kind of nice. So I got a 3-bedroom just for resale and renting. So you may want to keep it. But if you're buying a 1-bedroom condo, you're really limiting who you're going to be able to sell it to. So I would say get at least a 2-bedroom. The payment thing isn't that big of a deal. There is, I always, because like I think our older generation here, and I'm talking about my parents, like it was always the 30-year fixed, and that was your retirement, all the money that you put in, the principal and paying down the house. You're not going to live in this place for 30 years. So I would say keep the payment low. It's going to be lower than your rent is. There's all sorts of great products out there if your credit doesn't suck. And I would get on one of those. And then look, if you don't like it and you're lonely and you don't like living by yourself in a 2-bedroom condo, you can rent out the other room or you can rent out the whole thing and move in with your friends when his girlfriend dumps him. Problem solved. Okay. We're getting a lot of workout ones. Everybody's different. I am incredibly overrated in this department. I don't know how to help you. Some of you guys just aren't going to fill out, man. I hate saying that to you, but it's just not going to, you know, some of you guys just aren't going to be huge. Sorry. I tell you to go to Instagram. There's a lot of workouts there that you can find, but you know. Okay, this is a weird one. This is from a guy that plays football. I don't know if I'm supposed to say anybody's name now because everybody's... I'll just not say the guy's name because everybody's going to be able to figure it out if I do. A couple questions. A little background on me. I'm a football player at K-State prepping for my senior season. Have to adjust my training quite a bit due to the lack of access to weights. I was wondering what type of training you've been doing. Oh, see, here we go. Been doing during the quarantine. I assume with all the high prices on things like weights, you've adjusted your program quite a bit. Well... I actually am not in college, so I have a paycheck. So I went and spent way too much money on Rogue equipment. And I've got the full squat rack in my house now with a bench, plates, the whole deal. But he asked if I was doing more high reps, low weight. God, what is the point here? I would love to learn a little more about your style. Also, during school, I bartended events at a local hotel. During one event, a customer ordered a Moscow Mule, which is not on our menu. Keep in mind, there was a keg provided for the beer event. Am I within bartender rights to kick her out? This guy's a meathead. You wanted to kick out of a girl from a hotel event because she asked for a Moscow Mule? Moscow Mules are incredible. They're really tasty. They're refreshing as all hell. And I don't know if I even want to give you any workout tips, man. Sound mean. This isn't even real. This email's not real, Kyle. I don't know. Well, I don't know. I just looked. It might be real. I love that he likes the show. I like that he's checking in. I don't like that you thought it was okay to kick somebody out for asking for a Moscow Mule. I may not have all the information here. And I would say go on Instagram. Just go and look at those guys. They're somehow still in Bali in biking shorts working out. I don't know how that happened during a quarantine, but it's happening. Okay, last one, Kyle. There are some really good ones in here that you sent, so thanks. Ryan, at what age or what point did you accept being single and focusing on all of your attention on sports and other interests you have? I feel conflicted between wanting to find a girlfriend because I want the connection and continuing to watch 40-plus hours of sports per week. This whole quarantine situation hasn't been super helpful for this situation, either with the inability to socially date while also not having 3 hours of Dodgers games and NBA playoff games to rewatch every night. Thanks. Here's what I'm going to tell you, man. Okay, every single thing we do in life is a negotiation. If you are the one that's like the more desirable one in the relationship, which, because we can pretend this, it doesn't exist, but it does all exist. If you're like a catch for her versus her being a catch for you, you're probably going to be able to watch 40 plus hours a week of sports, even with a girlfriend. Now, if she is a catch for you and maybe is your apex mountain of dating, to use the rewatchables term, guess what you're not going to be doing, bud? You're not going to be watching 40 hours of baseball a week. You're just not. You know what's really hard to do is to justify to your girlfriend and then wife that you need to watch 40 hours of baseball or basketball a week, and that's not even including football, when you don't get paid for it. I get paid for it. And people that hang out with me still are like, are you serious? Like, you can't dial it back a little bit? And I was like, ah. So I've had a lot of guys kind of chime in on this deal where you go, hey, how are you able to do the 40 hours a week thing or whatever? And you just go, what? Like, what are you talking about? And be like, well, you know, my girlfriend doesn't really want me to do this. I'm like, okay, so she doesn't want you to watch 40 hours of baseball a week or basketball, or whatever it is. And you want to still have her as your girlfriend? I'm like, well, sort of. I'm like, you just answered your own question. You don't like her. It's not the baseball. If you like the other person enough or you don't want it to end, you will watch less baseball. I think it's pretty simple. Okay, Brian Curtis coming up here in a second, but I want to tell you about Postmates. I love food. That's why I love using Postmates, but I kind of love them even more right now because I can get food delivered without leaving the house or even now opening the door. I'm telling you right now, every order left at the door, they take a picture, I see it, boom. Given what's going on in the world, they created the non-contact deliveries. So now when I order from local restaurants, everything gets left right outside my door. They also have Postmate pickup so you can order takeout from your favorite local restaurants. Listen up, you guys need to be supporting your neighborhood spots right now. Now, I've been doing it usually a little bit more regularly. I was cooking like crazy, and then I just said, you know, I'm back on that Postmates train because the no contact thing, keeping it safe, and I just think it's good to be doing with the local businesses. And the great thing about it, too, for where I live, there's places that never delivered before that now are delivering, maybe the next town over, and Postmates has been able to bring that and make it happen. And Postmates doesn't just deliver burgers and sushi. They can make your life easier by picking up everything you need from Walgreens, 7-Eleven, or whichever stores you shop at, and dropping it off outside your door. Just download Postmates on the iOS or Android, find your favorites, and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use code RRSHOW. That's code RRSHOW for $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you download the Postmate app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. I would argue he's as good as anyone covering media. I know Bill Simmons feels that way. And every time he does a long form feature on somebody or a story in media, it's a must read for those of us, especially that are in it. And it's Brian Curtis from The Ringer. Now, not only do you have the Press Box podcast, but as I was making sure I get all this right, you're our editor too. I don't know that I was aware of that.
It's a fake title.
Oh, okay.
Editor at large.
Yes.
But
what does that mean?
It means I get pitched lots of stories online, and I also get pitched lots of opportunities to grow The Ringer's audience. And I'm like, I've never felt better to say I'm not in charge. there's someone else you're going to have to ask about that.
What's the worst pitch? What's the worst idea for a story that you were pitched recently?
Oh, you know, I get the super quarantine story that's like, this is the piece I've wanted to write my whole life. And nobody would ever take it because there were too many actual sports. So here it is, right? And The Athletic said no. So maybe The Ringer will say yes. That's pretty much what I get.
So you get a lot of that. All right. Yeah. Because that, right as you were saying that sentence, you go, no one would ever let me do this, but now. And you go, well, now it's probably a reason why no one let you do it before. So how did you, give me a little bit of your background and then transitioning into, you know, being media that covers media, which isn't the, it's not the only thing you do, but you do a good chunk of it. So I always think that pivot's kind of interesting for guys that start on one side of it.
I think I was, in a weird way, sort of destined to do this. And I don't mean that in a sort of, infatuated with myself way. But when I read newspapers as a kid, because all we had were newspapers, my line of vision would go from that big photo of like the Texas Rangers sliding into home plate above the fold and would go to the columnist's picture, who was like, you know, the picture that was the size of your driver's license photo. And I'd be like, what's that guy like? I want to know more about that guy. And that job did not exactly exist. So I would just write pieces when I could. I did a little bit for the New York Times when they had a quarterly magazine. But then the basic answer to your question is Bill let me. And Bill let me do it in a way that was interesting and not soul-killing. And I never had to write the column that said, you know, hey, I don't know if you watched that documentary on ESPN last night, but it got a 4.1. I mean, you know, 4.1. Not 4.0, not 4.2, but a 4.1. Big night for ESPN. Huge night. Congrats to all. He never made me write that column, which is why I wanted to keep doing this.
Did you have a huge poster then of like Rudy Martsky growing up?
Yeah, that was my fat head growing up in my bedroom.
You know, so that's pretty cool. Like I can always kind of think about things as a kid. I was like, oh, why I did that. And now what I do now actually makes a little bit more sense. So what was the first thing that you got reception on that it was like, okay, not only are you interested in this, but you're good at it too? Because I always feel like you find these things about the subject that I go, wow, I do this for a living. And I hadn't really ever thought of that angle.
It was a bunch of really punk columns I wrote when I was like in my 20s. Like I had one where I went back and looked at Mel Kiper's mock drafts and he was totally wrong. Like he was wrong 100% of the time in terms of picking which teams would pick actual players. And so I just wrote this column, but like this guy ranks all these prospects, but he has no idea what's going to happen in the draft, which now is probably more of a forgivable offense in my eyes, if we're being honest. But I thought, oh, yeah, God, you know, Mel, I'm gonna show the world that Mel doesn't quite know what he's talking about. But it'd be stuff like that because, you know, people hadn't written that maybe in quite that way back in the innocent days of 2001 or whenever that was. So I would just write that kind of stuff. And, you know, and then I got curious about like I was on the Rivals Network, you know, because I'm a University of Texas guy in the 2000s. So I would write a piece about why college football fans really like that kind of journalism, right? It was a little homerish, you know, but you kind of wanted the homerish environment. And in some ways that was preferable to a newspaper guy who was telling you that your team sucked. So I'd write columns like that. And it was basically just like what I was reading or observing. Nothing, no magic to it.
The punk thing is perfect because I don't know what it is about us, especially men in our 20s. We're collectively assholes. Like we just are. And we're more convinced we're right than maybe any other stage. And I'm more convinced I don't know the answers to stuff as I get older and older. But there's something about your 20s and especially something about going after the proven person when you have zero credibility. And the Mel thing's perfect. By the way, I'm going to stick up for Mel a little bit here. Did you do player for predicted slot? Is that how you graded it? Because that's a really hard way to do it. Because if like one's really off. Hard. Yeah, if one's off, then it sets the whole thing in motion. So you wouldn't give him any credit if he got like 26 first rounders right?
I was a tough critic. I was incredibly tough. I didn't, if there was
because you wanted to prove a point. You wanted to be, right.
Yeah. If there was a trade, I didn't let Mel off the hook. Absolutely. And by the way, when you're the punk 20-year-old, isn't it amazing 10, 20 years later when you then get to talk to all these people and it's this amazing reckoning of who brings it up, who brings it up, who doesn't bring it up but remembers, and who just totally forgot? It's kind of like three categories. And Mel, by the way, was whenever I've talked to Mel, no mention, you know, no mention. I mean, just he's totally Mel. So I don't know if he remembers. I don't know if he doesn't, but it's that's always funny to me. How, when you're a big shot media guy, how do you handle the punky 20-year-old who then grew up and, you know, became kind of a less punky middle-aged guy?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't forget, but I certainly wouldn't care though. You know what I mean? I would do it in a way. Well, I guess you'd say if you don't forget, that means you care. But I don't know. Like Mel's unbelievable. I stick up for him all the time to my buddies because if you meet him. He's unlike any other guy I've ever met. I'm serious, in the business. Like he has this way about him where it doesn't matter who you are on the totem pole at ESPN. He will stop and talk and make you feel like you're the biggest deal. Like he couldn't, like there's nothing more important than him asking you how you're doing and how your day's going. And then he'll follow up with you too. So it's not like the over the top insincere, look how great of a guy I am, like the next time Mel rolls through. Because a lot of guys have nailed that. And it was like, man, that guy's such a great guy. You'd be like, that whole 5 minute act, like you fell for that guy, forgot your name 12 seconds into the conversation. Mel's a different breed that way. And that's why I've always liked him, even though, it's really easy to pick apart. People hate mock draft guy, I think, almost as much as any sports media member. Because, ooh. No, I'm serious. Because like talk show, yes, because the opinion stuff. People don't get mad at anchors anymore. But if you look at, although play-by-play guy, like whenever I think of people talking about how much this play-by-play guy sucks, I'll say, hey, here's an exercise. Give me the list of your 10 most hated play-by-play guys in sports, and then give me a list of your favorite 10, and let me know which one's easier to fill out. Because we all know that it's the first one. But draft guy has a little extra to it. And I know this is the case for what I do too. It's like most people just listen to me and go, how fucking hard is that? Like, I could do that. I like basketball. I like football. I didn't play anywhere. That guy didn't play anything. He didn't even really cover anything. Like, how I could have just done that. And my thing will be like, yeah, but you didn't. So stop. And mock drafts, I do think that there's so many people that are into college football or into the draft that go, these guys get stuff wrong. Like, I could just go ahead and do that. I feel like mock draft guy angst is a number one seed.
Yeah, and then I've noticed week after, there's a lot of mock draft credit claiming for like the one third round pick you got right. That's how you take this big victory lap, right? And there's also draft guy gets this other round, because if draft guy likes your team's draft, he becomes huge, right? Like, oh, did you know Dane Brugler, A+. You know, yeah. And the guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, there'll be these long form rankings, like over the last 3 years, you know, this, you know, DougsPicks.tv has been the number one. There was a guy I saw taking credit for calling Brady to Tampa to his friend. He was a media member that had never tweeted it and was like, I knew this a month ago. I told at Steve100. And then I was like, wait a minute, is that like, this is a verified account? I go, this guy's actually taking a victory lap on telling his buddy and no one else that he thought Tom was going to Tampa Bay. But see, that's another thing too. Like, are you better off just telling everybody how awesome you are if you're in the media? Are you better off lying about your ratings? Are you better off just giving out the message, constantly telling people how great you are? Because then I think people actually just believe you. So I think it's the right way to do it.
We reward commitment to the bit. You know, that commitment to the bit papers over things we don't like. Like Stephen A., who was hated, you know, or kind of very, I would say had a big streak. You know, there was a lot of Stephen A. hate in the universe 5 years ago. I think eventually he was just so committed to being Stephen A. that a lot of that got papered over. I'd say Mel's in that category too, by the way. It's like, oh, look at this ridiculous draft guy. Remember that was a thing in the 80s? Who is this guy, that NFL draft? And it's like 30 years later, he's like the grand old man of the NFL draft. You know, he hung in there. So I do think all the incentives are to say, you're the best. You get great ratings, all that stuff, because then people sort of weirdly respect it in a way, rather than wondering out loud if you're doing the wrong thing with your life. you're approaching it the wrong way.
The Stephen A. thing is pretty interesting, though, because it wasn't, now it's sort of a funny eye roll about it, where you're right, when he was younger. Do you think it's just him getting older or people just accepting it?
There's been a lot of bad imitators, right? We recognize, I think at some level, that he's better at it than a lot of people who have tried to kind of fill in the corners of the Stephen A. universe. But yeah, I think as you get older, you become more respected. There's like a political version of this, where a senator who's like terrible, when they turn 90, it's like, you know, got to give him credit. He hung in there a long time.
Maybe. I don't know if they do that much anymore. Yeah. The only thing with Stephen A., and I've always liked him, I've gotten along with him, despite people thinking maybe we don't, but we get along. You know, we're not like close or anything like that. But I guess, I don't know if it's the bit. I do think he believes when he does an interview saying no one can sit at that desk with him, that he does believe that. And I, as somebody who does it, like I laugh at that. Like, what are you going to tackle me? Like, I just, you don't think there's some of us that can hang in a debate with you about stuff? But I wasn't really on that show after the Skip Bayless thing. I was supposed to be his fill-in, and then he got me banned from the show. So I didn't have that opportunity. So,
whoa, I didn't know that part.
Yeah, no, it's whatever. I've told the story before, so I don't want to be repetitive. Okay, so during everything that we're going through now, Brian, how have you seen things that have worked, haven't worked, as everybody that's on the sports side of this is trying to figure out a way to keep the content rolling because the stations don't turn off?
Well, it's like a spectrum, right? There's on the one hand that people saying the coronavirus is the only story in the world. So even if we're sports people, we have to sort of be reckoning with this in some way every day. When are the games going to come back? How are people feeling? You know, how are athletes feeling? What are athletes doing? That kind of thing. It's the only topic. And then there's this other side of the spectrum that says what people want right now, coronavirus wise, is being satisfied by Chris Cuomo and the nightly news and the Atlantic. And what we're supposed to do as sports people is just give people a chance to take a break from that for like an hour and a half a day. I don't think there's a wrong answer to this question. And I think a lot of us probably fit somewhere in the middle of that. You know, you're not pretending the coronavirus doesn't exist. We're not pretending that we're not stuck at home and all that stuff. But I guess what's been interesting to me is to see where people fit on that spectrum. And, you know, a lot of it's just like, what do you feel comfortable with? What are you good at, right, as a sports media dude or dudette? You know, what do you do? And how much, I guess, just how much, like, do you want to go there? But that, I mean, to me, that's what it'd been. I don't know that there have been a lot of huge surprises. I don't know that I've seen someone become, like, lean into virus talk that I wouldn't have expected before. I think people have mostly kind of complied. I don't know how you feel about this, but they've sort of landed about where I thought they would.
No, but you said something in the beginning of defining kind of the spectrum of it all. And if I were still doing the radio show and whatever I'm doing on the podcast, like, yes, I shouldn't. And we've done this too much because of social media, where we can start talking to a smaller audience than the actual audience that exists, which, you know, is a habit that all of us need to do a better job of breaking. But I want the show, if I were doing it, the podcast, I want that to be the escape. Every other moment outside of the time that you're spending with me, you're probably aware of or making decisions based on the coronavirus. So why do I then need to remind you for 3 hours that you're with me that the coronavirus exists? Like, the person that would go, well, you know, now's not the time to worry about Jameis's contract because of the coronavirus. I don't even want you listening because you're never going to get anything. You know, like, that's not, we're never going to talk. We're never going to hang out. We're not going to, because it goes without saying that the coronavirus is a bigger deal than Jameis Winston's contract. But for me, what I'm good at would be talking about Jameis Winston's contract. Now, when I think about the comparisons, because I think you've brought this up to 9/11, if you're on the air 9/11 in the moment, then you can't do anything on, you can't be doing like Yankees bullpen or how's the rotation going to line up in the playoffs. And that's where I thought Mike and the Mad Dog kind of showed how great they can be. And again, this is like 20 years ago. But in that moment, like, you have to kind of live react to it. I was on Mike and Mike. I did the full show the day after the Boston Marathon bombing because they just wanted me on. Hey, you know, you lived in the area, let's have a Boston guy on. So I did the 4 hours. I think it was just Greenberg and I, and that was the entire show. But this is so different because it isn't just the singular moment and then reaction to and keeping people updated, because you're a live source of information. I have no problem with people going, hey, I'm just going to do the sports show now as we're in month two, month three of this thing, to give you any kind of escape. I don't know how anybody could see that being the wrong thing or insensitive, because anyone with half a brain is aware of how serious this still is.
Yeah. The other thing I'd say is that in terms of sports radio, at least, right, so much of that was guy talk anyway, especially locally, right? A lot of stories about my family were worked in there way before coronavirus. So those just naturally transition. What are you doing at home with your kids right now? How do you work out? This may be a Ryan Russillo example, but how did your workout routine change, right? How does your life change? Like, I think that is probably pretty safe for everybody to do. And the other thing I'd bring up, and certainly this is a Ringer thing too, but it's like, on sports radio, sports and pop culture have become kind of the same thing. There are a lot of wire recaps on sports radio, just like there are in the Ringer podcast universe. So I think a lot of those guys that I've listened to have just sort of leaned into that a little bit more. And it's a way of sort of talking about the coronavirus, but not, you know, you're not doing Wolf Blitzer on the air, essentially.
No, and you shouldn't, because most of us aren't capable of pulling that off. Like, that's always potentially a mistake. Who do you like the most nationally when it comes to radio? And I think there's another part of this question too, where people could say, well, look at how podcasts are taking off. But I still think dismissing live daily radio will be a mistake. I almost think there'll be a correction where people go, you know what I miss is actual live reaction to things the minute they happen. As much as I should be talking up the future podcast and the money is shifted there, but to just dismiss live talk, live sports radio, I think would be a big mistake.
And I think everybody does it because it lives in a different universe than sports Twitter. Have you ever noticed that? Like some of the biggest guys on radio, you never see them, their stuff mentioned on sports Twitter unless they make like some terrible mistake or it's like, you know, back yeah. after this, right?
You
or something
have,
like
you have to screw up really bad or say like the craziest thing ever where like Felger in Boston said that Michael Jordan's a loser. So there exactly. you go. Boom.
You know. Boom. That's a bit, right?
Right.
But then you, and I think as a media person, I think, oh, radio must be fading. But then you go look at the Super Bowl and you're like, oh, actually all these radio shows are just making tons of money. You know, they've had layoffs during the coronavirus like anybody else, but like a lot of these radio stations are just still killing it. You know, even as we kind of enter the podcast world. Nationally is a great question because there's a lot of flavors of ice cream, right? I was actually talking to Kevin Clark about this the other day. I still, because of my respect for him as a media dude, is Dan Patrick is one that just comes up because he's found this really good way. And by the way, there are some people who try to get on this territory too of being like, I'm going to be big guest guy, small opinion guy. I'll come in when I need to. Right. But a very sportsy guest driven kind of show that comes on for a couple hours a day. It's very Dan, right? It's very, his, you know, 90s Sports Center persona translated to radio. I like that show a lot. And I wind up, I don't know that I'm like listening live a lot, but whenever I find segments of that on Twitter, I'm sort of locked into that. What else do I mix in nationally? I'll find some Coward segments that I mean, Coward to me is like the Rush Limbaugh of sports talk. And I mean that totally politically neutrally, just like, I'm just going to talk for 3 hours and I got this. I got this.
No one has been less afraid of the 9 a.m. start time red light than Colin Cowherd.
No, not at all.
No,
not at all.
Never. And I'll tell you, even when I thought I was like at my best and there were, it's always the solo verse paired up thing. You can't be great solo unless you just do it. And you know that second guy is never coming. But if I didn't write out everything and rethink it and all that stuff, when I was solo, I would go in and just be like, you know, and he doesn't care. He'd be like, whatever. I don't care. And, you know, there's just comfort in doing it for that long. I think Cowherd would be terrible with a co-host, like a regular everyday co-host telling him, no, I disagree. I think the look on Cowherd's face when somebody would just go, wait a minute, what? Like you're challenging my Cleveland Browns thing? I'm not, what the hell's going on here? Like, does this guy have an ID?
That metaphor didn't work for you? Like about this. How it's like when you're in a relationship and then this happens? That didn't land with you?
This is way easier when I just tease the next segment. What the hell's going on here? You mentioned as you were a kid, you know, you go like, look, this is the guy that I'm interested in. And then once you actually are doing it, you've been doing it for a couple decades. Do you feel like you're less harsh on someone because you're part of it? Or do some people feel like you're maybe internal affairs where this guy's covering me and critiquing me and, you know, he essentially does the same job?
I don't feel I'm less harsh. What's weird is it's just hard to be, it's hard to be friendly with people sometimes. It's not hard for me because that's sort of my job, right? Is to, you know, get people to talk to you and all that kind of stuff. But you know, when I'm walking around at the Super Bowl or over drinks or something, there's always this look in somebody's eyes like, are you going to use this? Is this on the record? Right. And journalists are great people to be friends with. So it just complicates sort of any relationship, you know, you might have because like I might have to write about this person at some point, you know, like a sports person or this person may, you know, interpret this in some way that I'm not trying to give off. I'm just talking to them, you know, and maybe they think I'm using it. Maybe they think I don't know what it is. I don't know. So it just makes it a little more complicated in that way. But no, I don't know. You know, to me, it's like you're as internal affairs as you need to be. What's the story, right? Some stories sort of demand that and you sort of want to know what the hell happened.
Do you have an example though, of something you were trying to track down that you knew was going to be kind of difficult and that people didn't want to share with you?
Trying to think of a semi-recent. Well, I mean, let's just think like ESPN is constantly this, right? because you're sort of constantly trying to figure out what's going on with like a tricky situation. And we could name nine things. We don't have to, but we can name nine things over the years, you know, that they've been on layoffs, right? That they've been involved in back a couple of years ago. You know, some controversy crisis on the air where you're trying to understand their relationship with the NFL, right? Where everybody is like, ooh, whoa, you know, I don't want to speak out of school here because that's like a $1 billion problem, right? If I say anything bad. So stuff like that, you know?
Okay. So let's hit on a few of those. What do you think is fair or the right way to go about it with the NFL part of it? If you're ESPN, because I see all the, no, but I see all the criticisms, right? I see the, well, you're a news organization. Like that used to be one of my favorite things. Like, not really. Like some people are journalists that work there, but this isn't the J school here. It's a business. And if the business of football is good for business, then ESPN trying to be delicate about that relationship may and probably should outweigh the rundown of a TV or radio show. You know, like no one ever came to me and said, never criticize the NFL. That never happened. Didn't happen once. But this is the other thing that I think is unfair. It's like, well, CBS doesn't have it. Well, CBS doesn't have multiple channels running sports content with opinions 24 hours a day, 7 days a week either. There's soap operas during the day, okay? And game shows. So they don't have to worry about somebody in The Price is Right ripping Roger Goodell. But I found people that covered ESPN, like media coverage people, would get really high and mighty about that relationship being blurred and be like, it's not blurred, it's clear as day. The NFL is good for business and ESPN's going to try their best to not mess with that.
You don't remember that time James Brown opened the NFL Today by ripping Roger Goodell for like 20 straight minutes, glancing over at Boomer, who was just kind of looking at the desk and, you know, no.
I was like, wait a minute. No, I was like, I definitely don't remember that.
Curtis being serious right. here?
Yeah.
So I would only push back on one part of that, which I don't...
Push back as much as you want, because there's people that think like, no, you're wrong. Like, that's not the way it should work.
As a business decision, it's obvious what they're doing. But I don't think, you know, if we had ESPN executives right here, right now, would they say, you know, actually, we've given several inches on journalism with the NFL. They would not admit that, in fact. They would not say that. And there are several journalists at ESPN who would not say, you know what? I'm a compromised NFL journalist, but I'm choosing to ride with it because it's a nice salary and I love my job at ESPN. So they're actually not saying that. So until they actually say that, I think poking at that sort of weird place where journalism and business meet and one wins out on one day and one wins out on the other day when Van Nod and Wickersham have this huge investigation that pulls Roger Goodell's pants down, which they do, by the way, pretty regularly. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think that's like an eternally interesting topic, right? The other part of this is that ESPN doesn't have to do journalism, right? It's not the New York Times. There's nothing in their charter. It's because John Walsh and Skipper and those guys were more interested in that, I think, than like another TV executive might have been. So they kind of pushed ESPN in that direction. They thought it gave them credibility. It did, you know, certainly and does. But to me, until there's like somebody that says exactly what you said, you know, this is good business. You know, so we're going to go 2 feet, but we're not going to go 10 feet on this story. Or we're going to do it for a day, but we're not going to do it for a week because we think that would maybe make somebody on Park Avenue mad. I think it's a totally legitimate topic.
Yeah, so like if I were in charge of that kind of stuff, and I never had any aspirations to ever be like behind the scenes and these things you hear about and you go, oh my God, you know, it's endlessly fascinating when somebody would open up to you. And every now and then somebody would pull you aside and be like, hey, I just want you to understand how this works so that you don't sound like a completely uninformed moron on the air for the rest of the week, right? And you're like, hey, I appreciate that. What needs to happen with a place like ESPN, it's just tough to compare anything to ESPN because it's just so massive and it has its arms and so many different things. But you have to go, look, we're going to pay you a ton of money for the NFL on Monday Night Football. And when somebody on a debate desk the next day rips something, like that's separate. That those aren't the same things. Like that really... Now, I know the NFL is going to push back with like, hey, we don't like the thing that happened on the debate desk. And then... I always felt like, especially with baseball, when Bud Selig was so out of control with how mad and how sensitive he would get about everything, like the stuff Selig would do where he would call and complain about people constantly. It's like, aren't you the commissioner of baseball? Like, do something else. Don't you have like stuff to do today? And he would make ESPN punish people. And I'd think, like, wouldn't somebody at ESPN just go, hey, who else is going to pay you this much for Sunday Night Baseball? No one? No one? Is no one the answer? Because, you know, just relax if a podcaster made a joke about a statue, which is exactly what happened. A podcaster made a joke about a C-League statue, which would be a target for pigeons from forever or something like that. And then the guy got suspended. And it's like, geez, for a throwaway line like that. So I guess going back to the point that I try to make here, Curtis, is that if I'm a consumer, I know certain people aren't journalists there. So I don't, like, whenever anybody would say to me, like, oh, you called it the D League, it's the G League. Surprised a journalist would get that wrong. Well, first of all, if you're mad about the G or D League, then you're a special breed to begin with. But I'm not, I'm trying to get things right. I'm trying to give you good information if I have information, because that's a little different with talk show hosts. But it's up to you kind of how you consume me. And I think those decisions are really easy to make. So if you're an executive at ESPN and you're going, we want to make sure that NFL relationship is really good, it's not a matter of, I want your show to say this, I don't want your show to say this. I guess I just feel like the job can be done without feeling like your journalistic integrity is being infringed upon.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of good journalists there, right? Which sort of proves the point to an extent. And there are people there whose job, as you say, is radically different from other people's jobs. I just say this. I think ESPN gets a lot of their credibility because of their journalism, right? People are tuning in there to get news, to get stuff that they think is, you know, not, doesn't, the NFL doesn't have its thumb on the scale. So as long as that is ESPN is drawing from that, which is, I think, fundamentally different than like CBS Sports or NBC Sports, as you pointed out, like the question of, is this journalism full stop? It's an interesting question. You know, it really is to me anyway. And I don't know, you know, my expectations for them, I wouldn't treat it like the New York Times, because it's not the New York Times, right? Or some newspaper or something like that. Because it is a financial relationship. But I don't know. To me, it's eternally fascinating. Because it changes all the time too, right? Sean McDonough, this is stated, this is not a secret, right? Part of the reason they took him off Monday Night Football, or one of the reasons they said afterwards, was, you know, he was kind of critical of the refs a lot. Guess what's happened? Sean McDonough's gone over to college football. I love Sean McDonough, by the way. Sean McDonough goes to college football. Do you know what he does? He just kills the refs all the time. So it's, well, like, it's okay over there, but we can't do it on the NFL.
Okay, well, I mean, anybody that grew up with Sean McDonough, like I did with Boston, and, you know, he's as talented a play-by-play guy as I think there is in the business. But that was Sean's thing. And Sean was incredibly good, but also gave you just enough of a homerism thing on the Red Sox call that you were like, all right, this guy's one of us. And of course, he's one of us as a Red Sox fan, his father and the whole Boston. I mean, look, it's the McDonough family's a big deal in Boston. But, you know, third inning, somebody would miss a call, and, you know, he'd just be like, well, Tim Sheeta, you know, his day wasn't a great start in the first inning, and Jimmy Williams is irate now, and I don't blame him because I don't know what game he's calling to. So, you know, it kind of plays a little bit on Nesson, and then he was doing the Friday night thing, and then when I would hear him doing it, and I hear him doing it on college football games, I do cringe a little, because you're absolutely right, because I go, oh man, now he'd have to deal with the conference commissioners. But the NFL part, like, even when I did fill-in NBA broadcast, I did two color and one play-by-play for radio for the Celtics. I had to fill out an NBA approval thing, and they had to approve me, like the league has to approve you. And now, as everyone's circling around this Monday night football booth and trying to figure out who's going to be in it, I'm finding it really interesting to see who's kissing the NFL's ass on social media because they want the gig, because they know they have to get the NFL to sign off on it to be in that booth. I mean, the same thing happened with, I think, was it Stan Van Gundy in the NBA? Because Stern was like, no. So it's a really, like, it's that thing that happens underneath where you go, wait, that happens? You go, yeah, like the TV people, and it isn't just ESPN. These business partners are so massive. Like, as I mentioned, the pushback on baseball, it actually doesn't happen because the fear is more that, I don't know, the baseball one I never quite understood, but with football, the fear is like, what if we end up not having football? And then you can't use the highlights, which everybody always mistakes, which is another big part of the entire package, is that you buy rights so you can also run the highlights on your SportsCenter and every other show that's running highlights.
To circle back to your point, I think most of this reveals just how ridiculously sensitive the leagues are. And by the way, even the NFL, I mean, forget Bud Selig. Like, who cares? If somebody's lighting you up on a talk show, who cares? If Sean McDonough said the ref was bad and it was a call that was obviously because ESPN is investing so much money in this, we can see from 19 angles was wrong. Who cares? Right? Like at some point, are people not watching Monday Night Football because they think the refs are bad? Is that the reason? You know, is that going to be part of the, I don't
if,
think
if you, if that was the standard, you'd think on a Twitter Sunday that no one wanted to watch the games.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, my favorite McDonough moment, as long as we're comparing them, can I do this? Sugar Bowl 2 years ago, refs get the call wrong, announce it wrong, get it wrong again, then re-huddle and come out to speak for a third time. And McDonough just goes, please stop talking.
Yeah.
On the broadcast.
You know, Mike Tirico, who I've always said, if he did the full-blown Mike Tirico radio show, I think he'd be as good as anybody in the country. But it's just different if you're also doing the talk show and you're part of Monday Night Football.
Mm-hmm.
And right. That's a tough spot to be in. It's a really tough spot to be in, to be one of the voices of the Shield here, essentially, and one of their biggest products, but then also opinionated enough 5 days a week, knowing there are going to be moments where you have to get critical of it. And I'm not saying like Mike can get critical, but I guess there's a part of me that, you know, I'm not saying I'm best friends with Tirico, but I feel like I've had enough conversations with him where if he ever just said, hey, I'm just going to do the full open Mike Tirico deal, he would be incredible, like incredible. And I know he had it for a little while, but he was also all over the place. You know, back when Tirico did his radio show, one of the things they were doing with Scott and I in the beginning, because they did it with Mike and Scott a lot, and it was one of the reasons when Will and I were going to do it, Will Kane and I were going to do it together. And then when I had heard, because no one told me, and Will's like, hey, I'm going to be in New York for a lot of these shows. And I went, so we're starting a radio show every day. We're going to be in separate locations. I'm like, all right, I've already done it. And it's just, you can maybe do it after you've done it in the same room for a few years and built up those patterns and understanding the other guy's delivery. But yeah, if Tirico just said, hey, I'm just doing radio and I'm in studio with somebody else, I think he'd be incredible.
By the way, I've loved listening to local sports radio during the work apart phase of the coronavirus to hear how these teams, because there's so much of it. You know how TV's kind of become junky and lo-fi? Radio now, it's like, it comes back, was there a liner there? What are we doing here? Are we doing the chicken strips ad? Like now it just, all it is just talking out loud to your producer and hoping for guidance. They don't get edited like we do, you know?
No, I was always a big fan of the hand signals and everything. More with Curtis, including the first time he met Skip Bayless, his hero. Upgrade your home, style, grooming routine, and more with a monthly box of awesome from Bespoke Post. Bespoke Post sends themed boxes of their favorite kitchen, grooming, outdoor gear, and more every month, introducing subscribers to unique small brands and one-of-a-kind products in the process. Whether you're looking to hone your knife skills, I love my axe collection. I wish I had more room out back, but, you know, I just bring them with me. Take better care of your skin or brew your own beer at home. You're going to love your box of awesome. Grab 20% off your first box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code Rosillo at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code Rosillo for 20% off your first box. And by the way, Bespoke Post has something really cool going on right now. It's an initiative called Support Small, where they're pledging to support the small business community during the coronavirus crisis by buying $10 million worth of goods from emerging brands and small manufacturers. So if you know any small brands looking for a boost right now, definitely give them a shout. Was there anybody that you wrote about or that you were covering that seemed to not only not want to do the interview with you, but was furious after you did the piece?
That's a good one. There's not too many that have not wanted to do it, you know, or at least have not admitted they wanted to do it.
That's a really good qualifier.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's part of it, right? You don't want to.
It's just so funny. But like, I can't let you know how bad I want you to interview me.
You don't want to talk to Curtis, but when, and maybe it takes a really long time to get him on the phone, but when you do get him on the phone, oh, happy to do it. Happy to do it. Were you really happy to do it? Is that why this is 4.5 weeks after I started asking? And the publicist told me no, like three times, or told me they couldn't get you, you know, that one, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to remember the roll call of my, especially the early days. You know, I had a tough piece about Bob Costas early on, to be honest. Tough piece. as they say. And you know,
can you that was, give us a little to share a little bit more on that?
He was doing the Olympics. It was when Bob was, I thought, is in his phase where he was talking about like end zone dancing a lot and stuff like that. And I didn't love that phase. You know, it's like, oh, what are these players today doing the end zone dances? Can't they flip the ball to the ref? You know, and I wrote a column in the New York Times. He was just doing the Olympic stuff. And
was that the pink eye Olympics?
That was what before that. Before okay. that. Several. This is early. This is early on. I think it was around the Will Leach time when he had the Will Leach thing. So that was a, yeah, that was a, that was not.
And what was the Will Leach thing? Who was a Deadspin?
Yeah, he had Will Leach on to talk about the evils of the internet, if you remember that. He had the Bob, I believe it was on his HBO show, and Buzz Bissinger was on there. This was like.
Wait, was that the Joe Buck thing, though? Or was
no,
that,
no, you're that remembering was different train wrecks here. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Joe Buck was the one with Artie Lang. Yeah, that's right. It was like Buzz Bissinger didn't understand how the internet worked. He thought the comment section was like part of the piece. And Will Leach is like, are you guys serious? Have you guys never been on the internet before? I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. That was a disaster. I mean, knowing that being in the media, like we all couldn't like Deadspin there because of what it was about early on. But then there were definitely media members that like would call Deadspin so that they were like, make sure I never get in trouble or anything like that. And Will, I remember, you're right. That was Buzz Bissinger reading the, he was reading comments on a piece, like post after, and he was losing. He's like, this is the worst. And Leach is like, what? Right. That's not my byline. That's right. Balls deep, 04, you know?
Yeah, if my memory serves, like Bissinger had the comments on a printed page. Yes,
that's right. That's right.
It's kind of pre-iPhone. Yeah, that was the whole thing. I mean, you know, another one is the Oklahoma City thing. You know, I think I did at Grantland. I mean, I did not hear back from them directly, but I think it was basically 110% chance that the Oklahoma City Thunder were not happy that I had written about their media relations thing. You know, which was freezing out writers and generally doing their best to keep writers as far apart from the players as it seemed like it was humanly possible.
Wasn't that the Westbrook time. Stuff?
Yeah, it was Westbrook. That was all KD was still there, you know, for part of that.
But that was always the thing is like Westbrook was so in control of everything that was going on down there that it was like, it was just sort of accepted.
Yeah. Oh, and like, it was the tone of the locker room, right? It was the tone of the thing. And then KD went to the Warriors and for a while he was really available. Remember that?
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, oh, yeah, what do you want to talk about? I'm in. Oh, we can do interviews now? Okay, I'm in. Yeah, I guess that was one of them.
So I feel like I cut you off on the Costas thing, but did he, like, reach out?
Well, I mean, I'll just say this. I just say it was not well received. I remember I got an angry letter from HBO about it, you know, and he was on HBO at the time. And yeah, that happens, you know, whatever.
Is there ever a time where they're like, hey, they were right? Or are you still that 20-year-old punk?
These are TV people we're talking about, right? You know, you made a good point when you wrote that column about me. No, I don't think that's ever happened. That's ever. I think it happens. But that's probably not unique to them, right? If you get ripped on Twitter, you're not like, you know what? You made a good point. I've decided to change part of my show because you just killed me. But you might do it anyway, right? You might just not admit it.
I did it once. Somebody wrote something about me and it was just totally factually wrong. And I sent a note to the person. I was like, are you serious, man? Like you did it this way. This is the way you did it. Like you don't even have the timeline right. There's facts I could tell you. Like you're not going to believe me, but I'll even share something with you that I'm not supposed to, but it's just, and I got like the biggest form, even though it was written to me specifically, it was the most form thing ever where it was, you should just learn to appreciate your success more. And I went, oh, and then I immediately regretted it. I go, I'm never doing that again. Never doing it again. Because the person it didn't matter what I had said. They'd already written what they had written about me. And it's just like, I was like, hey, you're wrong. They're thinking, no, this guy's making excuses. Like,
yeah, wrong. and they won because they got a response from you, right?
Is that how you felt when you got a response?
No, but I think there's a certain part of humanity that just wants you to respond. Like I got his attention, right? Even if they're totally wrong, and I got in that, you know, like, ooh, yeah, somebody's got a thin skin. Well, no, I'm just trying to correct it.
That sucks.
I'm just trying to correct it.
Whenever you respond, be like sensitive much. Do you have any thoughts now that we're 2 months into this? I've never been doomsday about this whole thing. I even though I know Fauci's like everybody's hero, I feel like he's constantly banging the drum on this message of like the worst case scenarios all the time. But that might be just him being precautionary and more on the safety side of things. So I'm open to that part of it. But as far as programming, like, do you get a sense? Have you talked to anybody about what kind of impact and maybe lasting changes that we would have from this? Or if we even know, well, you know, 2 months
in terms of the media?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be smaller. I mean, I think that's number one, by the way. And that, and I would put that from your biggest TV network down to your smallest local newspaper that's kind of hanging on for dear life. Like I'm one of these people who thinks all the downsizing that's happening during this thing, layoffs, furloughs, pay cuts, the idea that that's all just going to bounce back to 100% when we're done with this recession, when we're done with the coronavirus at whatever point in the future, that's a little rosy to me. And that's not saying that, you know, we're not going to have sports writers and podcasts and all that stuff. But I just think a lot of these changes are basically going to kind of be permanent. You know, the sports staff that had 12 people, they've downsized to 8 during coronavirus. Is that really going to bounce back to 12 next year? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that's interesting about this is just sports TV. Sports TV is one of the last things on television that still just gets millions of dollars pumped into it. The debate shows are pretty basic, right? But look at like Sunday Night Football. I mean, that show just look, or the Fox Game of the Week, right? Like those shows just look amazing. You know, there's tons of money in that. Now, there's two arguments. One is that there is going to be this post-virus reality where like, do we need to spend that much money? Do we really need to make those shows look as good as they do after we've been having people sitting here looking at each other like you and I are looking at each other on Zoom right now for like months? Or I guess maybe the other argument is we're going to be so desperate network-wise to have football back because football is already like 90% of TV networks at this point, and that we're just going to lean into that and it's going to look even better than ever. We're going to make it look better. I don't know, but that's an interesting question to me.
I worry about the industry for the numbers. And what I mean by the numbers, like whenever I don't do that often, but if I speak to like classes or something and, you know, you've got all of these kids, thousands and thousands of kids graduating every year from all these, you know, whether it's communications degrees, journalism schools, going to Newhouse, going to Missouri, going to Columbia, I'm leaving out a million of them, USC. Because I remember having my grad application at Newhouse School filled out and was actually like waiting to have enough in the checking account to cover the application fee as I was sending it off. Like I had my undergraduate from Vermont and I was ready to go, all right, well, if I need to do this and I need to do it really, I guess I got to go back to school because Vermont didn't have a communications degree at all. Like I was political science and English. So when I was talking to schools years ago, I would say, you know, the numbers just don't add up. And I know that sucks to hear, but the numbers don't add up. If you think about just talk radio, how many great jobs are there in the country? Are there 100? Like 100 might be high.
Mm-hmm.
Now, podcasting makes you think you have a path that wasn't available, but it doesn't mean just because you have the opportunity to do it, anyone's even going to listen to the thing. And then when you think of anchors, like those guys on average last 35 years at a major market, you know? And you can talk about the teams, but the number of the supply of people to be on the air versus actual available jobs, the math was never very good. And now it scares the hell out of me for somebody that really wants to pursue this. And you're right. Like, I don't know that it just all bounces back up, but what will happen is like same thing in any company that isn't even related to broadcasting. Like, hey, we had all this money. We were flush with investors. Now that money's gone and we're starting to realize, hey, you know what? Actually, we need to turn a profit now. Like we thought we were fine because we had all this cash and investors and seed money, but now they're saying we're out. So now we actually have to turn a profit instead of being projected a valuation. And I think that's going to happen to, and we're seeing it already with some of the writers where you go, I don't know if any of this stuff was going to work out, but now everybody's being forced to kind of make decisions they hope they only had to make in like 3 or 4 years.
Absolutely. And by the way, it's even more subtle than just numbers, right? You remember, because you and I both had them, those starting jobs in media where it was kind of barely a living wage. I'm going to guess that's going to be now just like slightly below a living wage.
Volunteer?
Yeah.
Mine was below. Mine was below the first three or four.
So mine was way below. I was in the, I'm going to pay one bill a month and it's going to be a different bill each month. this month cable, this month, you know, and you kind of just spread out, keep everybody on the leash a little bit, you know.
If you didn't have a bad credit score in your 20s, I don't even know if you got into broadcasting, really, you know.
No, it was not a thing. But I just think now that's going to be like worse in some little way, right? Which sucks if you're getting into it. You know, if it's $3,000 worse, $5,000, we're not going to have to talk about huge things here, right? That makes a lot of difference. And maybe it makes a difference if you're like, I'm going to hang in and do 5 years in this and see if I become, you know, big time, or am I just going to go be an accountant, right? Or just go do something else and just kind of drop out, maybe do my sports blog on the side and tweet a lot, right? And not be a media member, quote unquote. Like that's a big deal to people. And it was not exactly rosy before this. And it's only going to get worse, right? At least in the near term. And man, that sucks.
Yeah, the reason those entry-level jobs are as bad as they are is because they know they could get people to take them for free.
Totally.
And that's kind of the whole point. It's like, how bad do you want to do this? And that's like anything that's really special. The beginning part of it usually is almost impossible, and it'll want you to quit. It's not saying, hey, everybody that wants to get into broadcasting, make sure you get out of it. I mean, because there's something great too about following your dreams, and it's still going to happen. Like, there's people right now, they're going to graduate from school, they're going to have amazing careers, but The math was always bad before, and now I feel like it's way worse.
Did you have a Pete Carroll speech that you gave to a young person who would come and tell you, like, I want to be the next Ryan Russillo? Did you have one of those? Mm-hmm.
I've done a couple speeches to teams.
Yeah, but, not even at a podium. Just like they come to you, hey, Ryan, I'd love to be in the business. You know,
no,
tell me I can do this.
I've tried a few times, and every time I've done that, it turns into you just want a job. Like, they think that because they met me and I took a 1% interest in them, they think I'm just going to be able to call ESPN and be like, hey, this guy's got his shit together. Why don't we get him on the air?
Yeah, but you're powerful. So you get the, I still get the just like, should I be a sports writer guy, right?
And do you answer all of them?
I try to because I remember. I don't know. Did you have the, as a kid, did you do that? To people? Did you bug people?
I did it not as a kid. I did it as a 25, 26 year old, where I wrote letters to every team. But yeah, if you just DM me and say, hey, can I have a job? I mean, it's just,
well, that's a little direct, I think. But I do remember as a kid bugging people, you know.
What's the first one that jumps out?
You know who it was? Skip Bayless. Then a Dallas radio host and columnist, right? And I'd go to his remotes with my mom because I couldn't drive. And I have a picture of this, which I'll send you after we get off here. But I would wait for him to go to commercial, and then I'd kind of, you know, sheepishly walk up. Hey, Skip, I'd love to be a sports writer, you know, too, when I grow up. Do you have any advice? What should I major in? And you know what? He was great. And I remember that, right? I'll never forget that. And you know what? Did that help me get a job? No. Did that help me, you know, do, you know, something or whatever? But he could have blown me off. And again, we're talking like 2.5 minute intervals, right? Before Skip had to get back on and read the, you know, the car lease ad for the radio station. But he was great.
That's funny. When I lived in the same hotel with Skip, we got along great. I'd be like, wow, I really like this guy. He's really smart. I mean, there's no debating that. But he thought I said something about him that I didn't say. And then everybody came after me kind of internally about it. And I got really pissed and was like, hey, that's not what happened. And they were like, well, you need to apologize. I was like, why would I ever apologize for something I didn't even do? And it's super easy to figure out that I didn't do it. So they went back and listened to every single like NBA podcast I did where I supposedly had said that. Well, you know what? I'll just share with you. I did this thing where I was like, hey, everybody, all the fans that you get really upset about, understand you watch your team way more than any of us watch your team, okay? Except for like the select team that I'll watch or the one or two that I always want to watch all the time for the most part. And I'm a guy that watches all the time. So I'm going to tell you, now that I've been here a bunch of years, most of the guys that I work with that are on the air, they're not grinding away watching games. So if they say something, I know it's going to upset you, but understand that they haven't watched as much as you do. So why do you care? I go, I think I had said, when Skip Bayless says he's watched every single Chris Paul game, including every game at Wake of his entire career, like, it's just a dumb thing to say because it's not necessarily true, even though I know Skip Skip watches a lot. And then it turned into some guy posted a blog about how I said Skip doesn't watch any games. Mm-hmm. And that's not what I said. So then ESPN was like, okay, go back. And they made the podcast producer for me listen to like every pod I had done for a month, start to finish.
And they're like, it's painful.
Right,
I don't want to ever have to do that.
Yeah. I mean, he already heard him the first time. And I was like, look, I didn't say it the way it came out in this thing. Like, why won't you believe me? And they're like, nope. And then they're like, okay, well, we couldn't find it. I'm like, because I didn't say it that way. That was my fucking point. They're like, well, you should still apologize to him or you're never going to be on First Take again. I was like, no, I'm not apologizing. And my agent was like, you should apologize. I go, fuck that. I'm not apologizing. I didn't fucking do anything. And then that was it.
But see, this is like a guys with jobs problem, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about like 14-year-old who's got stars in his eyes problem here.
I see. What I was trying to do was reinforce you liking Skip because I had a stretch where I really liked him. Like, yeah. We would talk college ball. We'd be at the hotel and we'd run into each other. I'd be like, how's it going? You know?
Yeah.
And I'd be watching his high rep routine. But after that, I was like, nah, I'm out. Done.
I've talked to guys who did not, and young sports writers who did not have that good of an experience with the all they wanted was that sports writer who'd made it to look at them and go, I got a minute for you. I'm going to treat you like a real person and I want to take you seriously. Maybe you'll never do this, right? Most likely you're not going to do this because who's going to do it? You know, how many of us are really going to go all the way, right? But they didn't get that just nice scratch behind the ears and they never forgot it. Right. They never, ever forgot it. So I don't want to be that guy. Like, I don't want to have somebody nursing a grudge against me for the next like 10 years because, oh, you know, Curtis, I hit him up on LinkedIn and I never heard back, you know, because he thought I was marketing him something. You know, no, I want to try at least.
Well, that sounds like an invitation. He's at Brian Curtis. That's B-R-Y-A-N. Make sure you check out.
It's only serious candidates
at the Press Box Pod, and you can see all of his work up on the Ringer. Let's do this again, Brian. I know we'd always kind of talked about it. Maybe after some normalcy here, but I hope you had fun, man.
Absolutely, thanks, man.
Okay, that's it. Have a good weekend. We'll be checking in Sunday night after the Jordan doc, and man, that Rodman stuff really made the rounds. Where I said Rodman was boring, and then Bill had mentioned something about it too, and then I don't know, maybe we'll do it on the Bill thing, but also it's worth checking out too with all the breaking news that came out days later. But Bill and I talked about the Orlando thing, and I think it's almost worth, if I'm going to go do all that stuff, it's because I've talked to somebody and talked to multiple people, multiple somebodies, to go, hey, these are kind of some of the things that are kicking around. These are not guesses, folks. So just a little reminder for you on a Sunday night. Have a great time.